Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
While Richard Feidler is away, we're bringing you some of his favourite conversations from the past few years. The good news is he's very much better and will be back soon.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. My first guest for you today is Dr. Ingrid van Beek. Ingrid was living near Sydney's King's Cross early in the 1990s when she saw the hideous effects of the heroin epidemic at that time. Drug users passing out on the street, people on the nod on park benches, ambulances being called out to attend to overdose junkies. Today the drug problem hasn't gone away from the Cross, but it has shifted from the open streets. Dr. Ingrid van Beek was behind the 5-year campaign to open the first ever medically supervised injecting centre in the English-speaking world. She lobbied in the face of fierce opposition from the then Prime Minister, John Howard, from interference with the Vatican and the UN International Narcotics Control Board. But Ingrid van Beek did have the support of health professionals, some politicians and church charities. It opened in 2001 and there are claims that it saved lives and allowed ambulances to attend to other emergencies. Dr. Ingrid van Beek was right there at the centre of it all, and she's now returned to her original post as the full-time director of the Kirkton Road Centre in King's Cross. I dropped into the centre last night to pick up a copy of your book, and it's kind of an anonymous place, the centre, directly across from the train station in King's Cross. It looks fairly anonymous, and I was just in the reception to pick up the book. What lies beyond the main reception area there, Ingrid?
Well, it's a three-stage facility, so there's that first area that you would have gone into, the reception area where people are assessed and they say who they are and what drugs they've used, and we also get a full history from people when they first come on the first visit. And then they proceed through to the second stage, and that's where they are given clean injecting equipment and they can then proceed to inject at a sterile booth. And after they've injected, they dispose of the injecting equipment there into a sharp safe, and then they proceed through to the third stage, which is a less sort of clinical area, which we call the aftercare area, and that's where we've got counsellors, where we can engage with people, talk about the reasons that they're using drugs, living on the street, that sort of thing, and we try to, of course, encourage people to get into treatment or arrange other aspects of their lives that might be all over the place.
One of the key reasons you wanted to open it was to stop ambulance services being overburdened with call-outs to overdose cases. What happens when someone does overdose in the centre?
Well, it's usually in the second stage, although sometimes in the third stage. We've got specially qualified nurses who are able to administer resuscitation and also the drug naloxone, which reverses the effects of heroin. So that happens there and then, of course, much sooner than it would if this same thing had happened in a back lane, where it's really in the lap of the gods as to whether or not someone sees it, rings the ambulance finds the location, and then, you know, gets there in time to prevent, you know, first up, there's things like brain damage, which starts to kick in within minutes of, you know, not getting oxygen to the brain, through to death, of course, the most devastating effect of a heroin overdose.
The reasons that were put in place for it to be open were to stop these accidental overdoses, to, you know, save lives, and to stop the very public squalor of public injecting, and thirdly, to stop the call on ambulance services at the time. How successful has it been in achieving these goals, Ingrid?
Well, in King's Cross, the ambulance call-outs to heroin overdoses has dropped 80% since the injecting centre has been operating. It needs to be said, though, that there has been a heroin shortage in Australia over this last 8 years. But when we compare it, say, to the Surry Hills area, which has, of course, experienced the same heroin shortage, ambulance call-outs there have only dropped by 45%. So now there are actually more ambulance call-outs to Surry Hills than there are to King's Cross, which, you know, anybody who knows that area would appreciate that that's a complete reversal of the situation back in the past where, of course, you know, King's Cross was the capital for heroin overdoses in the country.
Is it still that way? Seeing the way it is, last night, you can see the suburb, the wealthy suburb of Potts Point, has gotten a lot wealthier over the last 15 years, certainly when I used to live there. And it seems to be colonising King's Cross instead of the other way around now. The wealthiness, if you like, of Potts Point seems to be creeping up towards the Cross. Is the Cross still a major heroin centre of heroin use in Sydney?
Well, there are still over 200 injecting episodes that occur every day at the injecting centre, and that's just during the hours that it's open. So I guess the way we would perceive it is that the injecting centre has actually enabled that colonisation, to use your word, or the gentrification of the rest of the area, so that it's moved what was previously happening literally on people's doorsteps into a clinical facility. And there, you know, of course, we can, as I said before, offer assistance and hopefully move people out of the area. And that's you know, what we're aiming to do. And
yeah, I don't think it was your intention to for this to happen, but maybe it's aided in the gentrification of the area.
Well, that's right. But having, you know, lived in the community myself and sat on many community committees over this last 20 years, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I guess, you know, the word gentrification tends to have a sort of pejorative sound to it. But, you know, I think for people to be able to live in safety and security is surely a sort of basic thing that we should be trying to achieve in all communities. And I think that, you know, that this community, even now, gentrified as it may be, still has a very humane and compassionate approach to matters to do with drugs, and has never supported a zero tolerance type of approach where, you know, just sweep it out into the next suburb, and, you know, strongly supportive, as all the polls show, of this type of approach. So, you know, actually see drug users as part of its community. And but at the same time, of course, you know, for the health of drug users, prefers that it not happen in back streets, and for their own sense of safety and security, would prefer it not be as visible and as public as that either.
Who doesn't get to be admitted to the injecting room centre?
There are a range of criteria. People have to be 18 years of age, and that's the legislation requires that. People can't, of course, be accompanied by a child. They can't be pregnant. People who are heavily intoxicated as well can't use the centre and are instead counselled about the dangers of, you know, using on the top of whatever drugs or alcohol they've had. Those are the main exclusion criteria.
How about people who want to inject drugs other than heroin?
Oh, there's a whole range of drugs that are injected there. It's often called the heroin injecting room, and that is the drug that's been used most commonly there. But across the 8 years, there's been, you know, big fluctuations in the types of drugs used at that facility. And the facility is aimed at reducing injecting-related harm, and any drug injected as opposed to used in other ways has got a whole range of harms associated, of course, including things like HIV and overdose. It's not just heroin that you can overdose from. You can, you know, become quite toxic from too much cocaine or methamphetamines or the other sorts of drugs that can be injected.
Yeah, what's your security like? Because people, after they've injected cocaine or methamphetamines, are going to be behaving very differently from those to go on the nod after they've injected heroin.
Well, I think that's certainly the common perception, but in fact that tends to be a slow escalation, and we assess people up front, as I was mentioning before, for signs of intoxication. So the centre actually has a role in stemming the escalation of psychosis that can otherwise occur when drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine are being used, you know, by people holed up in an apartment, for example, in a suburb or in back streets for that matter. So, you know, we see the very early signs of that type of psychosis, and we're able to treat it. We've got good links with, you know, mental health services in the area, and Kirkton Road Centre, of course, is also there to be able to treat those sorts of conditions.
My first guest today is Dr. Ingrid van Beek, who is the director of the Kirkton Road Centre in King's Cross in Sydney, and was key person in the establishment of Australia's first medically supervised injecting centre in King's Cross. As a doctor, I don't think it's I don't know if I've ever had anyone who was so vocationally keen on becoming a doctor from such an early age, Ingrid. When did you first get the bug, to be so to speak, to become a doctor, the viral condition of wanting to be a doctor?
It's a bit spooky. Certainly by the age of 10 or so, I was very keen on doing medicine, and that was even before my brother had commenced his medical studies, because he preceded me as a medical student at University of New South Wales and is now a rural GP, particularly focusing on obstetrics up in northern New South Wales. But even prior to that, I was pretty keen.
As a child, how keen were you to get into the inside of a hospital, Ingrid?
I know what you're getting at here. Yes, I was that keen that I did actually. I was a child malingerer. I pretended to have appendicitis at the ripe age of about 9, after my brother and father had both had appendicitis. So in the months before, I guess we'd visited them in hospital and so on. And
my turn.
when I had abdominal pains overnight, my brother, of course, said, "Oh, maybe, you know, it's appendicitis like we had." By the time the local doctor arrived, my mother had sort of changed the sheets and I'd had a bath and I was all tucked up, ready to be examined. I got to say, I was feeling just fine. But by that stage, yes, it sort of appealed. And I went ahead with pretending to have symptoms of appendicitis, so much so that they actually rushed me to a private hospital and had what was ended up being a lily white appendix removed later that afternoon.
How pleased were your parents to discover that you'd been faking it all?
Particularly because my parents were in sort of somewhat strapped financial circumstances, so actually having to get admitted to a private hospital as opposed to, you know, using the public system. But yes, they took it in their stride. But yes, then I also, when they were going to discharge me 2 days later, because of course I was completely well and ready to go home, I felt a bit cheated. So then I also said I had a bit of abdominal pain, so I got an extra day in hospital. And I wept when my mother came to pick me up. So
why? What's so lovely about the hospital?
Well, actually, the matron was particularly lovely and put plaits in my hair and big red ribbons, and I just thought it was great, all that sort of attention and so forth, perhaps. And for weeks afterwards, I spelt my dressing gown because it still had that sort of disinfectant smell. So it does sound a bit sort of creepy when I think about it now, but I think it might have been a sign.
You grew up in Wentworthville in the western suburbs of Sydney. What was it like in those days for a Westie to do a medical degree? Were you a bit of a fish out of water with all these smart kids from the North Shore and the eastern suburbs of Sydney?
It was certainly very unusual for someone who'd gone to a state school and came from the western suburbs and didn't have parents that were either well-off or academic backgrounds to be doing medicine. So, you know, I was among a handful of people with that sort of background out of sort of 250 or so in my medical year. But the upside was that I actually qualified for what was then called TEARS, which was a, you know, living away from home means-tested allowance, so I could actually move out of home and live in a flat with other, you know, flatmates in Coogee, and I thought that was all a fantastic experience.
Did you do it, you know, you're roughly the same age as me, and you know, when you were a uni student, you went out to the Cross and have fun. Do you remember the Cross in those days?
I do indeed. I remember, you know, the first sort of coffee shops there, the Piccolo Bar, and so on. That was, it was, and you know, the Pink Pussycat, which in fact now K2, a satellite service of Kirkton Road Centre, is now located in what was then the Pink Pussycat Club. So yeah, I remember all of those nightclubs.
It's a sad shadow of its former self, the Cross. It's a sad thing to say, isn't it?
In some ways it is, but it still has a great community spirit that I think sometimes people that don't live in the Cross don't realise.
You you were brought into the surgical training program under Victor Chang. You were one of his two registrars. That's a pretty big deal. But you left after a little while. Why didn't you proceed? Why didn't you go on to become a surgeon?
Well, that was part of the surgical rotation at the time. I was hoping to get onto the surgical training program at that stage, and I certainly had put in a lot of groundwork towards that. I was very keen on plastics and reconstructive surgery, and you know, doctors like Fiona Wood now continue to be people that I have great admiration for. But I realised it was almost sort of like an overnight thing that, in fact, the sort of culture associated with surgical training, particularly then, I think perhaps I was attracted to it because it was something that that females were at that stage really weren't welcomed into. But yeah, equally.
And you decided it wasn't for you though, surgery.
Yeah, that's right. I guess I also always had a sense that I should do something where there was a real need, and I didn't think there was a screaming need for female surgeons per se. And I wanted to do something that I felt that I was talented at, and even though I was certainly a proficient young trainee surgeon, I didn't think I had the gift. Working with someone like Victor Chang, you certainly see the difference between, you know, someone who has an incredible born talent, I suspect, to someone who can, you know, do the job well, but yeah, doesn't have that sort of gift.
So you noticed you had a bit of a flair for management instead, and took on a course for an MBA. Eventually, you took on the job as the director of the Kirkton Road Centre near King's Cross. And this was around about the time of the early 90s with the heroin epidemic at the time. What do you remember of that period living in and around King's Cross, of that epidemic of heroin?
Well, there were increasing numbers of people basically homeless, living on the streets, particularly young people. Drugs became, you know, heroin became so cheap. It was actually cheaper to buy heroin than it was to buy, you know, cannabis in that area. And yes, we were seeing people at Kirkton Road Centre, working with them, providing, you know, the full range of sort of healthcare. And then overnight, you know, we would hear the next morning that they'd died of an overdose. So, you know, everything was just over at that point. So that was, you know, on a weekly basis, that sort of thing would happen. And, you know, increasingly so during the 90s. And yes, as each new drug came into the area, that area would be sort of hit the hardest.
So what was the catalyst then for you to start this process of setting up a medically supervised injecting centre then? What was the thing that got the ball rolling?
Well, it was actually, interestingly, the sex clubs in the area that started to diversify. They were, of course, seeing street-based sex workers who, by and large, also inject drugs. So it was unsurprising that they would often inject on those premises, sometimes with their customers as well. But then the club started to appreciate that they could actually, you know, turn over more business by, instead of just renting those rooms on a short-term basis for casual commercial sex, to actually rent those rooms for the purposes of injecting. And so what increasingly evolved was that they would have this arrangement whereby people would then come up, you know, people who weren't sex workers at all, people who were injecting drug users, who then came with their drugs and injected on the premises. And then if they didn't emerge after 10 minutes, the person running the show would knock on the door. And if they had overdosed, then they would call the ambulance. So the ambulance service actually then got in contact with the local police to say that they'd increasingly been called to overdoses on these premises. And the commander at that time in 1990, a man called Jim McCluskey, he could already see that if he cracked down on this hard, that would just move all of that activity back out onto the streets. And that, you know, from a health perspective, from a drug user perspective, at least this was a sort of semi-supervised situation where, you know, after 10 minutes, yes, if they didn't emerge, somebody, you know, called the ambulance had a known location and some security provided as well. Plus, you know, it moved it off the street. So even some of the more conservative elements in King's Cross were discouraging the police from cracking down on this too heavily. But of course, you know, it was illegal.
So the police were in a real conundrum then. I mean, they're obliged to enforce the law, but they knew it would have, it would seem, a counterproductive effect.
That's right. And the risk, of course, was that those facilities, you know, would then also start, you know, selling drugs. And that's, of course, what eventually came to pass. But certainly public health people such as myself were, you know, encouraging the police to exercise some discretion. So where there was no evidence of drug supply, that maybe they might not, you know, go in and sort of force this back out onto the streets. But eventually, indeed, the Royal Commission was to reveal that, you know, quite a few of these establishments, and by the mid-90s there would have been at least a dozen establishments on either side of, you know, the main street there in King's Cross that had sort of shifted their business across to this type of thing, what then became known as illegal shooting galleries, which were then also found to be supplying drugs, and of course in some cases with the complicity of the local police, and it was, you know, that sort of corruption that then was revealed in the course of the Wood Royal Commission. But, you know, Wood himself in his recommendations noted that While, of course, that needed to be policed or you know, the drug supply needed to stop, that the health department consider licensing premises to substitute for those things. And eventually, you know, to cut a very long story short, that's what came to pass with the injecting centre.
Indeed, and you proceeded in the teeth of a lot of opposition, people with genuine concerns about it, some local businessmen. The Prime Minister, John Howard, at the time spoke out against it. The leader of the Salvation Army spoke out against it at the time. How did you manage to actually get it up in the teeth of that resistance?
Well, I guess we just kept chipping away. It went on for, you know, almost a year and a half, that sort of opposition. And there was certainly a time when, you know, we were also then, you know, sued by the Chamber of Commerce and Tourism. So we were in the Supreme Court. And then another group turned up to sue us as well. We almost just thought that this was going to be the way it was. You know, we would just endlessly be arguing the case and never get to open the doors. I had a strong belief that, you know, as long as we could just open the doors, that the people who had genuine concerns, that those concerns would be allayed. You know, these facilities had been operating in Europe quite successfully. It was the first in the English-speaking world, but there were 60 or so of these facilities that had been operating for as long as 15 years. So, you know, to that extent, it wasn't a groundbreaking thing.
The argument put at the time was that the state couldn't be seen to be condoning drug use like that. What was your argument?
But already, every state in Australia and every country virtually in the world was providing a needle syringe program. The injecting centre is just one step further. You know, we're giving clean injecting equipment and saying, instead of going out into a back street, stay here on the premises where we've got, you know, trained nurses and counsellors. If something goes wrong, we can resuscitate overdoses and we can get you in contact. We can build a better relationship with you and get you in contact with other services. So I couldn't see how the condoning drug use thing, that, you know, that argument had been won in the late 80s, I thought, with the needle syringe program, which again, where there was overwhelming evidence that providing clean equipment does not, you know, encourage people to use more drugs or drugs per se.
There was a fair bit of media interest in the opening of the centre, but you outfoxed the media rather cleverly by putting it on State of Origin night.
That's a Sunday night.
On a Sunday night, State of Origin was on, and the reporters who were positioned across the road to be there for the first person to walk through the door were watching Origin. It's rather clever, really. Who was the first person through the door once it was opened?
Well, in fact, we also allowed somebody to use the facility the week before. So we had a bit of a dress rehearsal just to see that the systems were all going well. And also, I suppose, in the back of our minds, we did predict that before too long after we opened the doors, media would be on the doorstep. So we were very concerned that the very first person to use the facility would end up being, you know, on the front of every newspaper. And we didn't think that that was a good idea, obviously.
So who was the first person to come through?
Well, it was somebody who's well known in the King's Cross area, a female who was in her 30s, and we sort of hand selected her to be the first person to, you know, trial our systems.
What didn't you expect to happen? What were the things that surprised you once you had it up and running and people were coming through?
I think particularly that people had so much difficulty injecting, and that there was so much blood present in the course of that. Even, you know, long-term injectors who were experienced and had good veins. I'd been working in the field for, you know, 15 years by that time, and talking to drug users on a daily basis, and I guess believing their reassurances that they knew how to inject. You know, we had a whole lot of material that we used to give people about safe injecting from an HIV and hepatitis B and C perspective, but it wasn't until we actually opened the doors and watched people inject that we realised the gap that was there. You know, what they thought was clean injecting was anything but from a, you know, medical perspective, and it really answered for us why we continue to have a problem with hepatitis C, where the prevalence is already very high, and it only takes, you know, getting it wrong once or twice, you know, to contract that particular virus. So that's also led to efforts that, you know, Kirkton Road and I personally have been very strongly involved in to actually prevent people making the transition to injecting. People often say, oh, but aren't you the one that, you know, ran that injecting centre? Like I'd somehow, you know, want people to inject, which, you know, of course I find quite you know, outrageous. I don't think many cardiologists are, you know, accused of encouraging people to smoke cigarettes. But, you know, so our efforts are right across the board. We try to prevent people taking up drug use, you know, prevent them from injecting as opposed to other ways of using their drugs. And then if they do inject, provide a safe facility where we can be sure that they don't die in the course of it.
How successful have you been in pointing people who come into the use of the services of the injecting room towards counselling and to actually getting off heroin?
Well, literally thousands of people have been referred over the last 8 years from that facility to various treatment and rehab programs. But addiction is a chronic relapsing condition. There's no, you know, magical cure. It takes a lot more than, you know, giving someone a ticket and saying, you know, here's a treatment facility, you know, off you go. If you've ever, you know, smoked cigarettes or had any other sort of addiction like that, you would know that overcoming that takes a lot more than, you know, good advice and knowledge that something's bad for you.
Ingrid, it's been great to meet you. Thank you so much for joining me in conversation.
Thank you.
It's Dr. Ingrid van Beek, the director of the Kirkton Road Centre in King's Cross and the first director of Sydney's Medically Supervised Injecting Centre.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.